for All March at 201 Park Avenue South at Union Square in Manhattan. With the repeal of the flawed and partially defunded Affordable Care Act on the horizon, and the abhorrent plans to replace it with something that is not care but a tax cut for the wealthy, it's time to let Congress know we wish to have health care for all people like all other modern industrialized nations, reads an official statement from resistors. It's very likely that they won't make a decision on Trump Care until the end of session in Congress, which is why we need to make our voices heard across the country to tell our elected officials that the option is Medicare for all. You can find out more at facebook.com/resistors. That's resistors with a Z. On Saturday, July 29th at noon, the New York State Youth Leadership Council is holding the UndocuQueer Summit for LGBTQ and Undocumented Immigrant Communities at 168 Canal Street in Manhattan. The event will consist of various group-building exercises that address mental health, communication, and organizing, according to an NYS Leadership Council official statement. Come with your anger, fear, and doubt, and we will provide love and support as a community. For too long, we've been asked to choose only one of our causes. Let July 29th be the day you stop finding yourself alone or hopeless. Email ximena@nysylc.org for more information or call 646-820-9521. That's the WBAI Resistance Calendar for the week ending Saturday, July 22nd. I'm Jesse Lynn.
Nestor Robert Marley was a reggae superstar, an uncompromising champion of human rights, and a spiritual and political force throughout the world. Join the award-winning Midnight Ravers on Friday, July 21st, 2017, from 12 midnight to 2 a.m., as we proudly present our Summerthon special, Bob Marley, Before the Legend, The Early Seeds, as told by acclaimed actress and producer, Esther Anderson. This special provides fresh insight into Marley, Chris Blackwell, Island Records, and Jamaica, and is the definitive story of Marley's early years. So listen and be edified, and show your financial support. That's Friday, July 21st, from 12 midnight to 2 a.m., only on WBAI in New York, 99.5 FM. You know how we do it.
The Midnight Ravers, where every show is a special.
BAI, WBAI is an important, vital New York City institution.
New York State Assembly member Richard Gottfried speaking out on the station's dispute with Empire State Realty Trust over the lease which houses our transmitter.
Now, I don't expect the real estate folks that own the Empire State Building to think that they're in the business of making charitable contributions to WBAI. But I do expect them to be good citizens. You know, the New York metropolitan area is very good to the Empire State Building. The Empire State Building should give back a little to the metropolitan area. And helping to keep WBAI alive, I believe, is a reasonable piece of their corporate responsibility. So I say to the Empire State Building, you're part of New York. Do the right thing as New Yorkers.
And you can do the right thing with your pledge by entering 41444 on your smartphone and then text TRANSMIT 995. Again, that's 41444 and TRANSMIT 995. Many thanks.
Thank you.
Rest, you will find me at the time I love the best, watching rainbows play on sunlight, pools of water, ice cream, cold nights in the morning. Can't you imagine it? It's the morning of my life, yeah. In the daytime, I will meet you as before, you will find me waiting by the ocean floor, building castles in the shifting sands, in a world nobody understands. In the morning is the morning of my life, is the morning of my life. You will find me at the time I love the best, watching rainbows play on sunlight, pools of water, ice cream, cold nights in the morning. Can't you imagine it? It's the morning of my life, yeah. In the daytime, I will meet you as before, you will find me waiting by the ocean floor, building castles in the shifting sands, in a world nobody understands. In the morning is the morning of my life, is the morning of my life.
Oh, in the morning of our lives, this morning a two-hour special, how Africa's great civilizations birth Western European societies. We're going to go through a breathtaking look at the history of Africa's great civilizations, from the birth of humankind to the dawn of the 20th century. Our journey will take us through 200,000 years of history, from the origins on the African continent of art, writing, and civilization itself, through the millennia in which Africa and Africans shaped not only their own rich civilizations, but also the wider world. When Africa turns up generally on a history program, it's often because another cache of ancient bones have been found there. And maybe there's a mention of mitochondrial Eve and a map showing how early humans migrated out of Africa and populated the world. But these programs generally leave a 200,000-year void between the paleoanthropological find and today. But it wasn't just our DNA that originated in Africa when those early human beings migrated out of Africa. They weren't traveling alone. They were carrying something within them, and that something had developed slowly over millennia. It was culture. So we will travel all over the continent, visiting sites where writing and art evolved, and where centers of population and power evolved along with them. We'll learn about the Iron Age kingdom of Aksum, south of Egypt, the 13th century great library of Timbuktu, the development of Zanzibar into an intercontinental trading hub, and oh, much more. Africa gave us the blueprint for civilization itself. And at its core, our special is a recognition of the profundity of African history and the development of Africa's great civilizations as a precursor to those that evolved in Rome, Greece, and through Western Europe. Indeed, it is the great African civilizations that must be widely celebrated for their gifts to and place in the development of the modern world. And we begin our sojourn with Langston Hughes' poems, I See Rivers.
I've known rivers. I've known rivers ancient as the world and older than the flow of human blood and human veins. My soul has grown deep like the rivers. I bathed in the Euphrates when dawns were young. I built my hut near the Congo, and it lulled me to sleep. I looked upon the Nile and raised the pyramids above it. I heard the singing of the Mississippi when Abe Lincoln went down to New Orleans, and I've seen its muddy bosom turn all golden in the sunset. I've known rivers, ancient, dusky rivers. My soul has grown deep like the rivers.
While Egypt would dominate northeastern Africa, further south, on the banks of the Nile in modern-day Sudan, another center of power was growing. The earliest settlement in Kerma has been dated to 4000 BC. Settlements in Mesopotamia formed into the earliest cities. But recent archaeological finds show that Kerma was developing into a complex society at the same time. By 2500 BC, it's estimated that the city's population had grown to over 10,000, and its power and wealth rivaled that of its northern neighbor, Egypt. Today, little remains of what was once a magnificent planned city, built around monumental architecture as grand as that of early Egypt.
The archaeology of the city itself centered around what seems to be a vast structure. This is known as the Defufa. Different scholars have different ideas about what it could be. In terms of mud brick architecture, it certainly seems to be the largest and earliest in Africa.
The Nubian kingdom had its own distinct culture and religion and was renowned for its deadly archers.
This was a defensive town, so there is a big defense wall surrounding the area. Most of the houses here was built of mud brick, so people still use the same technique from the past until now. The town itself was well organized. It was divided to several parts. In each part, there is a big hut for a prince, and he's control his area, while the central part for the king.
For over 2,000 years, the kingdoms of Kush and Egypt prospered and grew as kindred civilizations at opposite ends of the Nile Valley. By 1500 BC, Egypt was the world's greatest power, controlling trade routes to the Middle East. But Egypt's gateway to the precious resources of the interior of Africa was Kush. Kush supplied luxury items such as gold to Egypt's flourishing 18th dynasty. From Tutankhamun's face mask to the trading expeditions led by Hatshepsut and the wealth amassed by Queen Nefertiti, Egyptian pharaohs required endless supplies of exotic goods to help their passage into the afterlife. It's difficult to imagine any people anywhere who resisted the finality of death more lavishly than did the Egyptians. The king's sacred tomb would be filled with every conceivable luxury to accompany him through the afterlife. Leopard skins, ostrich feathers, ivory, precious stones, and gold from Nubia's bountifully laden mines.
Gold is the skin of the gods. The goddess Hathor, as face of the sun, is the woman's face on Phos with the cowl, ears, as gold.
It is a metal that never corrodes, and so they recognized this as being the perfect material for funerary goods.
We see the royals being adorned with gold, and we find from myriad, even lesser elite houses, we see gold objects.
The gold mining regions of the Eastern Desert really force the ancient Egyptians and the ancient Nubians to continue the close associations they already culturally had. So one of the reasons why Egypt can't let go of Nubia, and it's one of the reasons Nubia is both so attractive and potentially dangerous.
The relationship between Egypt and the Kushite kingdom was one of intimacy, proximity, and bitter rivalry. The Egyptians felt threatened by Nubia and wanted to control the gold mines themselves.
The kingdom of Kerma and Egypt seemed to have had what you might call a difficult relationship. At this point, the Egyptians were writing of Nubia as vile Kush, so we know there was certainly a lot of venom from the Egyptian side.
Eventually, rivalry led to conflict, culminating in a war that would bring to an end 15 centuries of independent Kushite rule.
Every time you have civilizations develop in the world, what you have is warfare and bloodshed, because other people want the stuff that you've got. And that becomes a part of the history of civilization.
Around 1500 BC, standing at the prow of a flotilla of ships, Pharaoh Thutmose I led his troops to war against the Kushite kingdom. Thutmose I, not born of royal blood, had served as a general to the previous pharaoh and earned a reputation as a formidable military strategist.
For the Egyptians, Nubia was a very strategic location.
What we see is Thutmose going very determinedly to the south, and he sacks the city of Kerma. To sack the capital city of this kingdom was truly a feat. The Nubians were well-known warriors and fighters. There are stories of thousands of captured prisoners of war being executed in a variety of different ways.
Lest anyone doubt the finality of the conquest, Thutmose strapped the body of the fallen Nubian king to the front of his ship. Egypt is the chief, he declared, while peoples across the whole earth are her servants.
Nubia became a second part of Egypt.
The 18th dynasty is really a period of time when the Egyptian presence in Nubia expands.
For 400 years, the people of Kush would struggle under and against Egyptian rule, while Egypt plundered the kingdom's gold mines through annual tribute. Kushite royal tradition survived south of the regions that Egypt ruled.
All of Nubia is incorporated into Egypt more fully than ever before. Nubia gets a shadow government that mirrors pharaonic Egypt. You get a viceroy of Kush, the king's son of Kush, who, like Pharaoh, is in charge of all of Nubia.
The Egyptians also brought along their culture and their gods.
We know that already in the 18th dynasty, the ancient Egyptians were building temples in Nubia to Egyptian gods, but Egyptian gods that had a local relevance for the Nubians.
Amun, god of gods in Egypt for 400 years. 700 years later, the Kushites made this all-powerful deity their own, incorporating him into their pantheon alongside their lion-headed god, Apetamak. The Egyptians built an awe-inspiring temple to Amun at the southernmost tip of their Nubian empire at the holy site of Jebel Barkal. This would also become a sacred place for the Kushites.
For the ancient Egyptians and the ancient Kushites, this pinnacle symbolized a serpent that was a protective deity on the crown of the pharaoh that spit fire and poison at the pharaoh's enemies. So this is what gave Jebel Barkal its mystical association that led Egyptians and Kushites to build and rebuild and expand their temples over the centuries.
But after 1100 BC, parts of Kush regained their independence. And by 750 BC, Egypt, following invasions by Libyan tribes, was greatly diminished and fragmented. Around 750 BC, Pianki, a new Kushite king, came to the throne. He He was brilliant and ambitious, driven in part by his fervent worship of the god Amun.
He clearly made Jebel Barkal an important place. He built a palace here. He very significantly expanded the temple. And Barkal was very clearly the center of his symbolic assertion of kingship.
Pianki turned his sights northward, to Egypt, portraying Kush as the champion of Amun.
Nubia appears to see itself as the real Egypt, because they're the real worshippers of the Egyptian gods.
It's remarkable that the Nubians adopted Egyptian culture and religion and civilization to the point that they believed that they were better Egyptians than the Egyptians who were currently in control of the Nile Valley. So when Pianki invades Egypt, he does so in the name of the god Amun. Pianki essentially cast his invasion of Egypt as a holy war of the reestablishment of the proper worship of the god Amun.
At the head of a powerful army, Pianki set sail north down the Nile, ready to invade the once impregnable empire of Egypt. He ordered his men to purify themselves in the river. "I shall let Egypt," he said, "taste the taste of my fingers." In a campaign that lasted nearly a year, Pianki's army conquered Egypt as far north as the Nile Delta. Triumphant, Pianki was crowned pharaoh of Nubia and Egypt, and founder of the 25th dynasty of Egypt's pharaohs. The Kushites, once the conquered, now became the conquerors, reuniting fragmented Egypt under their rule.
We can see the Nubian conquest of Egypt as both a holy war and a strategic expansion to the north. And obviously it was a great prize to rule both Egypt and Nubia.
They're ruling over an empire that runs from Meroe down in the south, clear up to the Delta, larger than any territory Egypt itself ever ruled over.
In some ways it can be seen as a turning of the tables that Nubia, who's always the underdog, now has Egypt as the underdog. It simply shows, I think, over and over again, how Upper Egypt and Nubia are so closely associated, ideologically.
This was the start of a new era in Egypt, which would see it ruled by a dynasty that historians call the Black Pharaohs of the Nile, restoring prosperity and stability back to Egypt. But across Africa, in the lush forest of modern-day Central African Republic, new radical technological innovations were laying the foundation for other civilizations. Sometime between 1800 and 1500 BC, small communities of craftspeople gathered to stoke furnaces, intending to fire ceramic. But in the lateritic African soil, the craftsmen discovered a byproduct, iron.
Iron is one of those inventions that actually has a tremendous impact.
We suspect the first usages were for decoration, for ornamentation. But very quickly, people would begin to see, oh, hey, we can shape this.
Each metal has a certain quality, iron for its strength, and the kind of tools that one can create with it.
In terms of converting economies from hunting and gathering to agriculture, iron began to be used particularly as currencies, but also in terms of agricultural production.
We previously thought that iron had been discovered in Turkey around 1500 BC, but new evidence reveals that iron working emerged at the same time in Africa.
Africa's great civilizations. This morning special, in this the last week of our spring fun drive, where we the people support our radio station, the People's Voice, the People's radio station. Africa's great civilizations have been suppressed. And we want to change the way people outside Africa think about the continent. Too often, people conjure up images of poverty and disease because few know of Africa's great empires, its powerful leaders, its art and the trade routes that shaped the continent and beyond. The story of Africa has been systematically denied to us for two reasons. The first is slavery. The second is colonialism. Europeans had to invent an Africa as a place of emptiness and barrenness and backwardness in order to justify the enslavement of 12.5 million human beings who were shipped across the Atlantic Ocean between 1501 and roughly 1866. And then, after slavery was abolished, the slave trade, that is, European colonial powers, looked at a big, empty map of Africa and carved it up like you would carve up a pizza. And they just passed out slices. They'd say, okay, Germany, you want Tanganyika? Belgium? You want the Congo region? Well, the stories of Africa and Africans to be woven into the story of the history of the development of civilization. I want everyone, every school child, to understand from day one that they are a citizen of the world. And this morning, an 8-hour series, Africa's Great Civilization, takes a new look at the history of Africa, from the birth of humankind to the dawn of the 20th century. This is a breathtaking personal journey, really, through 200,000 years of history, from the origins on the African continent of art and writing, civilization itself, through the millennia in which Africa and Africans shaped not only their own rich civilizations, but also the wider world. So, procrastinators, this is the final week of WBAI's Super Spring Fund Drive, its membership drive to increase its listener base and raise the necessary capital to keep us going. We are indeed a special voice in the wilderness, a voice that is progressive, that is filled with momentum and energy to really tell the truth and to dare to speak truth to power. WBAI. And when you call 516-620-3602, that number is 516-620-3602 this morning for your contribution to WBAI of $150, you will get Africa's Great Civilizations. And, you know, I have to say that I really think of this package as in part an anti-gun violence package. Say what? Yes, because youth who know their roots, their history, its grandeur, its contributions to the development of the world have a sense of being grounded, have an identity that so can't easily be exploited or crushed by bourgeois materialist vulgarities dangled in front of them. They develop a different depth of identity and camaraderie with their brethren throughout the diaspora. They can see through the political perversions of Western nationalism that operates through militarism and fostering discrimination and to keep people poor, to be controlled when they dissent, or used and misused when the elite need their bodies to serve their ends. Oh, yes, this is an anti-gun violence package. Know your history, and you know yourself. And when you know yourself, you respond differently to those around you. And for white folks, this series, Great African Civilizations, re-educates us and carves away at the indoctrination of the superiority of Western civilization, of Greece and Rome, as the apexes. And when the myths of the supremacy of white nationalism are picked apart, we can free our minds from the tyranny of white supremacy and open ourselves up to the culture and contributions of others and enhance our sensitivities and begin to form the alliances and friendships that can truly work towards empowering us, the people, against the robber barons that rule. You will feel all the lies of white supremacy culturally leaving your mind and freeing it to receive the incredible contributions to life itself of the people of the world, of a broader notice of humanity that's not founded in discrimination and concepts of dominance and inferiority, men over women, whites over people of color, Western culture over Asian and African culture, straight over LGBTQIA sisters and brothers. Great African Civilizations, you must have this package of 8 hours of films that have material that has never been produced and seen before. It is the epic story, and it's full of surprises and unexpected connections of Africa, helping us to appreciate the collective and individual genius of Africans who, across thousands of years, built civilizations and empires, fought wars, established great cities, furthered and spread learning, and created some of the most sublime art and architecture in human history. When you go to your phone now and call 516-620-3602 and support this outstanding educational trumpet of learning, of progressive thought, of intellectuality, of social good and activism, of efforts towards the empowerment of the people, a station that, yes, helped free Oscar Lopez Rivera, the Mandela of Puerto Rico, a station that helped win the freedom of political prisoner Sekou Odinga, a station that helped defeat U.S. imperialism in Vietnam, a station that helped defeat the apartheid system in South Africa, a station that stood with the indigenous people, the water protectors at Standing Rock, a station that was there to push for 15 and a union to fight for labor rights beyond that, a station that is there to fight for 60 years for LGBTQIA rights, a station that is there to fight for reproductive rights and against sterilization abuse of our sisters, a station that has been there to fight against environmental racism and climate change, a station that is there to oppose the U.S.-led and financed wars around the world, a station that is there to champion the BDS movement and for the self-determination and right of return of the Palestinian people and so much more when you, in the final week of this drive, give your dollars this morning, $150 contribution to WBAI when you call 516-620-3602. You will have the opportunity to get Africa's great civilizations, the 8-hour film anthology that is there for people of conscience, must be there in every classroom, must be there as a must-watch for family, for friends, in faith-based organizations, because Africa's great civilizations are vital. History is more vital than ever. And part of the expression, the 8 hours of the expression, is the film Motherland, which is the most concise and polished cinematographic representation of the African continent to date. It is the best documentary film I have seen on representing the continent of Africa, a betrayal of the African people which educates, enlightens, empowers. This is your opportunity to both care for, support this outstanding, critically important, 60-year triumphant radio station, because we explode the myth that commercial media, including the more liberal wing of the media, whether NPR or MSNBC or The Times and such, aren't reporting shaded by material interests of their financiers. That their interest editorially and what they cover and refuse to aren't slanted to preserve the interests of the oligarchs. But WBAI is entirely funded by you, the people. You put the people into the heart and soul of the station that determines the nature of our reporting, of our broadcast, of your voice, your broadcast. You have determined what we cover. The decimation of our civil liberties, the rollback of our civil rights. You are the ones who determine. Indeed, it's your voices, you the movers and shakers for social change and the empowerment of the marginalized and the disenfranchised, the discriminated against, and those who do the work and whose services, whose blood, sweat, and tears are thieved by the bosses, by the plutocrats. That's who we are partisan to. This station is your signature. It is your belief system. And you, as agents of reparatory justice and empowerment, it seeks to lift you up, and you lift it up and radiate these messages forward. How important is that to support? Call 516-620-3602 and ask for Africa's great civilization. 8 hours of unprecedented, magnificent, corrective film history. And I must tell you that the film Motherland, which is a component part of the package Africa's Great Civilizations, it is otherwise unavailable, and it is absolutely spectacular. spectacular. You know, when a person from South Africa watches this film, they are learning about Ethiopia and Kenya and Rwanda. And they all see their interconnections about nationalities and ethnic groups. These are films that do this, not only imparting information, but building a social place where people gather to see them and further interacting and understanding the challenges that face their lives as Africans in the diaspora. The plethora of voices from African Americans, from Ghanaians, from Malians enriches the story of Africa in the most beautiful way. Someone is strong on politics, and another is strong on culture. These various and different and differing people, however, harmonize in one Pan-African song to sing through the negative media image of Africa and speak in dignity and reaffirming terms about the story of great African civilizations. Africa's great civilizations, a $150 pledge, and we return to Africa's great civilizations, a clip from a piece of the 8 hours of film genius, cinematographic brilliance. The films are gorgeous in their production, profound in their statements, and educative in the extreme. Let's listen.
For a long time, the idea that iron could be smelted in sub-Saharan Africa was completely dismissed.
The new evidence is that ironworking begins right in the heart of Africa. We find dates of around 1,000 in Lake Chad area, 900 as we get toward the middle of Nigeria, 700 to 500 BC over in Mali, showing the spread of iron coming out of that area.
Even with the kinds of technology that we have today, it's incredibly difficult to produce a smelt in the way that people would have, you know, 3,000 years ago.
People talk about civilizations, and they think everything new and exciting begins in a civilization. Turns out, when you look at history, human beings create advanced new technologies out of their own experiences. They don't have to live in this kind of society or that kind of society.
The ironworking communities of Central Africa left little tangible evidence of their existence behind, but they did leave their technological legacy, together with a sophisticated artistic heritage unique to this part of Africa.
Near the center of modern-day Nigeria during the first millennium BC, a remarkable artistic tradition of terracotta sculpture emerged. These pieces are highly sophisticated, intricately detailed, and technically accomplished. Yet much of the culture from which they were created remains a mystery. They're known as the Nok terracottas, and they are sublime.
In 1943, a farmer from a village called Nok gave archaeologist Bernard Fagg the head of a scarecrow. On closer inspection, Fagg estimated that the finely sculpted head dated back to around 900 BC, making it, outside of Egypt, the earliest sculptural art found in Africa.
They have this very elaborate hairstyles and very heavy jewelry around the neck. So we assume it depicts people, maybe high-ranking people in ceremonial attire.
The current thinking is that it was probably traveling artists who were moving around creating these works for individual. It could have been courts or distinctive religious traditions. That certainly makes a lot of sense simply because of the breadth of the distribution of these works.
The height of the Nok period is during the last 1,000 years BC. This is the period in the archaeology we know the ironworking is reaching this area.
Throughout Central Africa, new communities were taking shape. From 3000 BC, an incredible movement of people and technologies unfolded that would change the face of Africa. It's known as the Bantu Migration.
The migration is particularly significant because about two-thirds of sub-Saharan Africa is populated by Bantu speakers. By 1000 BCE, Bantu have entered into Eastern Africa, and societies like the Swahili society that we know of and the Zulu that we know in Southern Africa start to emerge.
While the people of Central Africa were building new societies based on iron, this great technological advancement was also transforming the civilizations along the Nile, and nowhere more so than in Merowe. Built on what was once a fertile green island on the banks of the Nile, Merowe, by 500 BC, had become the new capital of the independent kingdom of Kush.
It was an area that supported agriculture, that had the royal city there, so life was probably relatively comfortable for most of the population at Merowe.
The rulers of the Third Age of Kush created a powerful kingdom, evidence of which can still be seen in their monumental legacy at Merowe.
These pyramids were burial chambers for the kings and queens of Merowe. More than 100 dot the skyline on this island.
The wealth of Kush had been founded on its abundant reserves of gold, which it could trade with the ancient world. But there was another resource that would generate wealth for the state and would come to define Merowe.
It's long been known that Merowe was an ironworking center because there were these enormous slag heaps in that urban part of the town. It was used for weapons, iron blades, iron spearheads.
And those weapons would be needed to defend Kush in the face of a new threat. In 31 BC, Cleopatra's Egypt, once the greatest empire in the Mediterranean, was defeated by the Romans. The Roman military machine was the most powerful in the ancient world, annexing territories from Britain to the Middle East and Africa. Now it turned its sights onto Kush.
One of the things the Romans did is they pushed the southern boundary of Egypt further into Meroitic territory. And what we do know is that the Meroites started to push back.
Halting this Roman advance would call for strong and decisive leadership from Merowe.
One of the most unusual things about the kingdom of Kush is the surprising number of queens that ruled.
They were known as Kandakis.
In about 100 years, we have four of these tremendously powerful Kandakis, and they are terrifically effective.
Without doubt, the most famous of those queens was a one-eyed warrior named Amani Rinas, who risked her life in battle to defend her kingdom and make sure that her people could live securely.
Amani Rinas reigned from 40 to 10 BC. Said to have the figure of a man by the Greek philosopher Strabo, she had a fearsome reputation as a military leader and strategist. For 5 years, Amani Rinas led attacks into Roman Egypt, preventing the Romans from invading Kush. These battles were recorded in Roman documents, but a first-hand account written by the Kushites themselves was recorded in their own Meroitic script.
When does this stela date from?
Well, it dates from the second half of the first century BC, during the reign of the queen Amani Rinas. In the case of Meroitic, the writing system has been deciphered already a century ago, but it is the language that is a problem.
So, why, with all computer technologies, why can't we crack the one African written script from the ancient world?
It is a bit as if I was asking you, as an English native speaker, to read me a text in Polish. You would be able to read it perfectly, but probably you won't be able to understand it, except place name and names. This is where we are with Meroitic script.
But it's about a particular battle with the Romans.
Exactly. So this is giving us the Meroitic version of the story of the war against the Roman. Unfortunately, we are not able yet to see what they are saying.
Amani Rinas showed her utter disdain for the Roman Emperor, Augustus Caesar, by By capturing his bronze bust during an attack on his forces and placing it beneath the threshold of her grand temple to be trodden underfoot by all who entered.
So all the people in the kingdom are stepping over the great Caesar Augustus' head.
Yes. According to the archaeological evidences we have, it's clear. She brought back the head of Augustus, of his bronze statue.
Despite the might of the Roman Empire, Amani Rainus' clever military tactics eventually brought both sides to the negotiating table, where the formidable Nubian queen successfully brokered a peace treaty with Augustus Caesar himself.
Are you telling me a one-eyed black woman was able to defeat the most powerful army on the face of the earth in 23 BC here in the Kingdom of Kush?
Yes, that's what happened.
Amani Rainus, the victorious African queen, would ensure the independence of the Kushite kingdom and its splendid culture for another 400 years. Human history was born on the African continent, which makes Africa the wellspring from which all of the world's history flows. Africa is the birthplace of art and music, the first writing, agriculture, and systems of laws. Africa gave us the blueprint for civilization itself.
These records speak to us across millennia as profound refutations of the claim that Africans lacked a history before Europeans arrived. This is the true history of Africa, and it's only just begun.
In the following centuries, the world's great religions, Christianity and Islam, molded in their infancy in Africa, would grow and transform the fate of the world. Great empires would prosper and cultures would blossom as a result, but they would also draw the continent into bloody conflict.
Special on Africa's great civilizations during this, our final week of the spring fund drive to capitalize, to support WBAI, this 60-year-plus broadcasting gem with the voices of we, the people. Africa has 3,000 distinct ethnic groups, 2,000 languages. It is home of the most genetically diverse people on Earth. It is the world's second largest and second most populous continent, at about 30.2 million kilometers. It covers 6% of the Earth's total surface area and 20.4% of the total land area. With approximately 58 countries, it occupies a wide, dynamic latitude. It has its deserts and forest and snow and temperature changes. Temperate climates, tropics, sun tropics, lakes, the longest river, the lowest point on earth, and mountain ranges. A continent of Africa. You know, the modern orchestra has its historical roots in ancient Egypt, Africa. The first orchestras were made up of small groups of musicians that gathered for festivals, holidays, or funerals. You can learn about Mansa Musa's Hajj, which may have even indirectly funded support for the Italian Renaissance and was the only time in recorded history that one man directly controlled the price of gold in the Mediterranean. Mansa Musa's Hajj, which is said by some to have directly funded support for the Italian Renaissance. The greatest increase in world literacy took place in Africa, where countries with rates in the 30 and 40% group changed to 50 and 60%. Ancient Egypt, made up of diverse polities, lasted 3,000 years. From 3000 BCE, founding of the first dynasty, until it was conquered by Persia around 525 BCE. Oh, and you can learn about Abu Bakr the second, who ruled what was arguably the richest and largest empire on earth, covering nearly all of West Africa. The Mali king, Mansa Musa, who is said to have told the Arabic historian Al-Umari that his predecessors had launched two expeditions from West Africa to discover the limits of the Atlantic Ocean. You will find out about the wall paintings found in Ethiopia and Eritrea depicting human activity. Some of the older paintings are thought to date back to around 10,000 BC, making them some of the oldest in Africa. The expansion of the Bantu languages, which started around 5,000 years before, present in West and Central Africa and spread all throughout sub-Saharan Africa, may present one of the major and most rapid demographic movements in the history of the human species. Dear sisters and brothers, this is an enormous opportunity to acquire this 8-featured film set, 8 hours, that is, of listening and watching, that will change the way people outside of Africa think about the continent, that dispels the myths that conjure up images of poverty and disease, because few know of the great empires, the powerful leaders, the arts and trade routes that shape the continent and beyond. This is your opportunity when you contribute your dollars to fund and support this incomparably significant radio station that is your signature, that believes wholeheartedly and works towards peace and justice in the world. This station, WBAI, when you contribute your dollars this morning, a $150 pledge, when you call 516-620-3602, 516-620-3602, and ask for Africa's Great Civilization, you will get the 8 hours of film history of Africa's great civilizations, which includes the outstanding, significant films 500 Years Later, a film by Owen Alak Shahada, 500 Years Later, which can best be described by saying the African proverb, until the lions tell their tale, the story of the hunt will always glorify the hunter. Filmed on 5 continents, 500 Years Later is a critically acclaimed, multi-award-winning journey infused with the spirit and music of liberation. It chronicles the struggle of a people who have fought and continue to fight for the most essential human rights, self-determination. And you will get the motherland also by Owen Alik Shahara, the critically acclaimed film that is not available in other venues. It is of such grand significance. It is the best documentary film that I have ever seen on representing the continent of Africa, the motherland. The visuals are superb. The economic chapters help people understand what is going on in Africa financially. Motherland is the most powerful documentary on Africa, fusing history, culture, politics, and contemporary issues. Africa's great civilizations, because the story of Africa has been systematically denied to us for two critical reasons. The first is slavery. The second is colonialism. Europeans had to invent an Africa as a place of emptiness and barrenness and backwardness in order to justify the enslavement of 12.5 million human beings who were shipped across the Atlantic Ocean between 1501 and roughly 1866. And then after slavery abolished the slave trade, European colonial powers looked at a big empty map of Africa and carved it up like you would carve up, as I said earlier, a pizza. They just passed out slices. They'd say, okay, Germany, you want Tanganyika? Okay, Belgium, the Congo? The stories of Africa and its Africans must be woven into the story of the history of the development of civilization. And I want everyone, every person, every school child to understand from day one that they are citizens of the world. The real history. The history of empires rising and falling and civilizations rising and falling that people in the West know so little about. These are sophisticated societies. The first iron technology in the world was developed in Africa in 1800 BC, even earlier than in India and the Middle East. And here's another amazing thing. Almost all of the gold used in Europe between 1000 AD and 1500 AD, it was mined in one of three regions in West Africa. 516-620-3602, 516-620-3602. And I want to just set it up for you with the poem, I've Known Rivers, by Langston Hughes, and this is Langston reading it, to take us back to Africa's great civilizations. And again, this is an 8-hour film, Gems, that you will not have seen or experienced any place else. And I am so eager for you to have these. And you will when you call 516-620-3602 this morning and support WBAI, a $150 pledge, and then just ask for Africa's great civilizations. People are standing by to take your call now. And I must say, Africa and its people are the most written about and the least understood of all the world's peoples. This condition started in the 15th and 16th centuries with the beginning of the slave trade. The Europeans not only colonized most of the world, but they began to colonize information about the world and its people. And in order to do this, they had to forget or pretend to forget all that they had previously known about the Africans.
I've known rivers. I've known rivers ancient as the world and older than the flow of human blood in human veins. My soul has grown deep like the rivers. I bathed in the Euphrates when dawns were young. I built my hut near the Congo, and it lulled me to sleep. I looked upon the Nile and raised the pyramids above it. I heard the singing of the Mississippi when Abe Lincoln went down to New Orleans, and I've seen its muddy bosom turn all golden in the sunset. I've known rivers, ancient, dusky rivers. My soul has grown deep like the rivers.
When Fez was reaching its peak, a new center of scholarship emerged 1,200 miles away on the southern shore of the Sahara Desert. It became a kind of sister city to Fez, and no less legendary, the fabled city of Timbuktu.
Since the 14th century, Timbuktu has been a place of mystery in the imagination of the West, a metaphor for the remotest place on Earth. But Timbuktu has become one of the great cities of the medieval world, an unparalleled center of scholarship, learning, and trade.
Timbuktu had its own counterpart to Fez's Karawee, the Sankore Mosque.
Timbuktu really attracted a lot of very learned scholars, and the Sankore Mosque in particular became really the university of West Africa for Muslims. So if you were an Islamic scholar and you were living in a village in the Gambia, let's say, one of your aspirations would be if you really studied hard and you did well, you might go up to Timbuktu, and that was like the PhD.
The heart of Timbuktu's intellectual life was its libraries. Between the 14th and the 17th centuries, they acquired hundreds of thousands of books, mostly written by African authors working in the city.
The first time I visited Timbuktu and saw those astonishing libraries with their wealth of scholarly text, I wanted to cry. I grew up being told that Africans never wrote books, yet here was this astonishing treasure trove of extraordinary handwritten manuscripts. Many of them were religious, but there were also books about math, astronomy, philosophy. I felt incredible pride and vindication.
Books produced in Timbuktu became valuable objects in themselves, prized all over Africa and beyond.
Leo Africanus, he talks about Timbuktu, and he mentions how it's such an important center for the book trade, and how books are sold, and they sold for very high prices, and so on.
There's a manual that has everything that a learned scholar in the bend of the Niger River in the 1400s needs to know. How to keep your wife happy, how to get in and out of a canoe, how to help a woman who isn't producing enough milk to nurse her child. It's a window onto all of the concerns and preoccupations of an African Muslim society in the 1400s.
Timbuktu became one of the principal cities of a rising new power in West Africa, the Empire of Mali. Mali was founded around the year 1240 by a legendary warrior king called Sanjata, who grew his small provincial kingdom into the largest state that has ever existed in West Africa.
When King Sanjata assembled his army, he ordered his local chiefs to surrender their titles. Such was the reverence accorded to the king that his subjects were said to approach him on their knees. Mali would become a great empire with political, military, and religious power concentrated in the figure of the emperor.
The Empire of Mali takes the mantle from the Empire of Ghana insofar as it comes to control the gold trade from West Africa. But it doesn't just take over, it expands. So this is the time when the gold trade really reaches its height and when the kind of wealth and opulence of the West African imperial states are greatest.
Through its control of the gold trade, Mali became a superpower of the medieval world. But gold was just one of its products, exchanged through a complex commercial network that traversed the desert.
Even though the Sahara Desert looks empty, it's actually, they've got trading communities located within the desert, and there are stages of trade that go back and forth.
When we talk about the trans-Saharan trade, it gives the sense or the impression that goods were transiting through the Sahara to get to markets to the north. But there's a sense in which the Sahara was a world in its own, and a very integrated world.
One of the most valuable items in the trade originated within the desert itself. Salt.
Salt is the refrigeration of the ancient world, right? So that you can't, you know, have meat or fish or any kind of, you know, protein products last more than a couple of days unless you salt them and smoke them. Salt is almost impossible to find in sub-Saharan West Africa, except when people are making sea salt.
In the Sahara, salt was mined, and mined in forms that were like slabs. It could be carried for hundreds of miles on the back of camels.
Another commonly traded commodity made salt mining even more profitable: slaves. Slaves were captured as a result of military action, such as war or sometimes raids, then sold to Berber traders.
There were some slaves that were incorporated in the trans-Saharan trade in the early period. There's actually not just an export of trade of slaves from sub-Saharan Africa in small numbers, but there's also an import of slaves into sub-Saharan Africa from North Africa and Europe, also in small numbers.
And they would settle the slaves around oases to grow cereals and other crops. Slaves also worked in gold mines. Much of the surplus that went into long-distance trade was actually production based on slavery.
It wasn't only commodities like gold, salt, or slaves that moved across the desert. Traders also carried with them treasured personal possessions. The British Library in London holds one such object, a saddlebag Quran.
Gus, what's a saddlebag Quran?
A saddlebag Quran is, it's a loose-leafed Quran that would fit into a bag so that it could be carried with you wherever you went.
Who would have produced this, created this beautiful edition of the Quran?
Well, this is by one hand. These are breaks to particular bits in the Quran, and so they have illustrations in them. So it's someone who understood that this had to be not just accurate, but also incredibly beautiful, because it's about uplifting people, not just through words, but also aesthetically. So this was for families, for people who would travel abroad, and they wanted to have a Quran, but they also wanted something where they could take leaves out, they could refer to it, they could look at it.
And share them.
And share them, exactly. This would be something that, through its accumulated use, could become more important.
So like the Gates Family Bible, which was started by my great-grandmother.
Exactly.
Merchants could afford such luxury objects in part because of the ever-increasing global demand for Mali's gold.
Probably something like 3/4 of the gold that's going into North African and European markets in the medieval period is coming out of the Empire of Mali.
Throughout most of the Middle Ages, Europe was on the gold standard, and without African gold, the whole currency of Europe basically would fall. They were already melting down Roman coins in this period to try to make up in part for this lack.
Mali's role in global commerce brought it recognition, respect, and envy from afar. This is the Catalan Atlas, a map dating from 1375, probably owned by King Charles V of France. On its southern edge is Mali, personified by its greatest ruler, the legendary emperor Mansa Musa.
Gus, it's such a surprise to see a black man on a map from the 14th century. How did Mansa Musa get on this atlas?
This was a known figure in Europe. This was someone who had influence not just within Africa, but beyond. And he was interested himself in seeing beyond his own kingdom.
And he's represented with this, the gold orb,
yes,
gold crown, gold scepter.
Yes. And it's a fantastically wealthy kingdom. It has some of the